Hi, I'm Adrienne Hill, and this is your Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of July 19th, 2013. All this month, we're doing something special on Marketplace Money. We're going back to the basics, how to invest, the rules behind debt and credit. Think the practical in personal finance. This weekend, how to save for a rainy day.
We are in money saving mode.
I have a savings account, so if I wanted to, I could probably save 5 or 6 times what I'm doing right now. I kind of want to enjoy my money right now, so I'm not at the point where I feel like I need to be saving like that.
I could probably save more, but I actually have it set up automatically to just take 10% every 2 weeks out of my checkings and in my savings account. And then the nice thing about that is you don't think about it.
The thing is, I got a checking in the savings, but all the money is in my savings. So I got to switch it to my checking, but it's going to take 3 business days. I don't think it's going to go through.
I save, but not as much as I want to.
Yeah, I mean, I try to do like 10 to 20% of my paycheck into my savings every time I get paid. I attempt to do that. I'm not the best at it, but I try.
Grandma said I could use this money to buy whatever I want.
Stan, now more than ever, you need to understand the importance of saving money.
Here's the thing about savings. It's probably the most simple thing in personal finance. There's no algorithm, no complicated formula, no elaborate jargon. Just take a portion of what you earn and put it aside. But that's the finance part of it. The personal is really where we run into some trouble. You have to make the choice. Most folks will tell you they want to save more, but they can't figure out how. So we asked Suzanne Hsu to join us. She's an assistant professor at UCLA Anderson School of Management, and she studies how we make decisions around saving. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Adrienne.
So let's start with the basics. The savings rate in the U.S. is somewhere around 3% right now. I've seen estimates that a quarter of Americans have no emergency savings at all. Why are we not good savers?
There are lots of reasons, okay. both in a logistic sense of how mm-hmm. easy or hard it is to save. Do we have the right vehicles or accounts to be able to save in? But also a lot of behavioral reasons, which is the type of research I focus on for why we don't save. Why do we as human beings kind of mess up this important decision?
Right. It's really, why do we?
It's a lot like actually dieting and exercising and not smoking and all of these other things that we have a hard time with. And a lot of the same psychology is involved for saving. First of all, saving is something that you need to do for a future you. It's not right. something you're going to benefit from right this instant. As human beings, we tend to live very much in the moment. We're very tempted by the things that are in front of us. And it's very hard to think about doing something. It's almost an altruistic act to save for somebody that will be your future self.
I find myself confronted with this all the time. I think most of us do. How did you decide whether or not to buy that pair of shoes or say, no, I really don't need it. I should save it for later.
Right, exactly. It is tough. There's some amazing research going on by folks that I know, Hal Hirschfield at NYU, Dan Bartels at the University of Chicago. They look at these issues of what makes us connected or unconnected to future selves. And for example, Hal has done some great work of showing people pictures of their aged self. And even a few financial companies have picked this up and now have websites that you can go to and put in a picture of yourself and it'll age it and sort of make you feel a little bit more connected to that future individual. So that things like that can help. Thinking about what your future life might be like might help. But that turns out to be a very tough thing to do to get us to care enough about that future person. Even though if we know that saving is really important
right.
and we intend to, and when they survey workers who have access to 401ks but aren't using them, and they say, would you like to save more? They all say, oh, yes, I'd love to save more. I intend to save more. Next year, maybe I'll save more. And that gets into one of the other big behaviors that gets us in trouble is because we live for the moment, we are very focused on the things that sort of need to get done today.
Mm-hmm.
Saving is a big, complex decision to really feel like we're doing it right. You know, do I invest in stocks or bonds? And what should I be buying? Should I do a target date fund? There's all these very complex things that a lot of us don't understand. And so it's easy to say, well, I'll worry about it tomorrow.
I'll do it later.
I'll do it later. Right? Just like I'll start my diet tomorrow. I'll do it later. At some point in the future, I'll have more time. I'll sit down. I'll do it right. I'll do it later. Even when people want to save, even when they have that motivation, it's very hard to sort of sit down and force yourself to do it.
What should we do? How do we get over sort of our inertia and our inability to imagine our future selves and actually do this?
So here's two things that I would recommend.
Okay.
One is take that first step. And it doesn't have to be a perfect first step. That saying that the perfect is the enemy of the good sometimes, right? Is exactly true here, that if you can just sign up for the 401k at work or find some savings account that you can start and set it up so that it automatically every month puts some money aside, even if it's not tons of money, even if you're not sure how it should be invested or what to do with it, just get started. Do something to get started. And along with that, to deal with the future self problem, give yourself a little bit of a reward for doing it. So
what are we talking about?
You know, like for me, a piece of chocolate cake would be awfully motivating, but we all have our own favorite things. You know, something small that's not going to be expensive, but you can use it as a way of saying, I did something good and I deserve a reward for that. And you know, and continue to reward yourself if you can continue saving. Find it as a way to.
So that's interesting. So it's actually reward your present self for what you're doing for your future self.
Exactly. I mean, another way that you could do that, which might be a little bit more complex, but maybe even more motivating, is for every $100 you put away into a long-term savings account, maybe put $10 away into a more short-run savings account, and at the end of 6 months, take yourself out to a nice dinner or something like that, right? Find a way to make savings have a short-run benefit as well as a long-run benefit.
And have there been other saving strategies that have worked for you in your personal life? You roll your eyes.
It's tough, I admit. I am someone who is a little bit of a natural saver, so making it so that you don't have to think about it is one of the big keys. And that's certainly what I do, is once a year I sit down and figure out how much of my salary I want saved, and I set it up so that it'll be automatic, and then I tend to try to not look back and not think about that, not doubt it. It's taken out of my paycheck, and I just don't think about it from that point.
Suzanne Hsu is an assistant professor at UCLA Anderson School of Management. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We asked our Facebook friends what encourages them to save. Sandra wrote, "Fear is my prime motivator. I know I'm saving enough when I don't panic about it." What about you? What keeps you saving? Let us know on Facebook or Twitter. We're at Radio Piggy Bank. The choice to save comes down to each of us, deciding that's what we want to do. And it's tough. It can mean wearing the same boring shoes instead of buying those new turquoise flats, or trying to explain to your kid why they can't have the new PlayStation. But a funded savings account can also be the difference between an annoyance and a catastrophe if your car breaks down. On today's show, we're talking about strategies to make savings a little easier. And we thought we'd check out a few programs around the country set up to encourage people to save, starting in Los Angeles, where Olivia Calderon is the director of the Financial Empowerment Initiative for the city.
When folks don't have an emergency savings to be able to use as a cushion when they have an emergency, it just, you know, makes them vulnerable.
One of the programs she helps oversee is called Bank on LA, which helps connect people with low and no-fee bank accounts.
We need to do everything in our power to make it easy for families to build their savings. And the most basic ways of doing that is a bank account.
Calderon says 64% of Angelenos who make less than $30,000 a year don't have a savings account.
You're not going to start saving if you don't have a savings account. It's going to be very difficult for you to do so.
By helping people establish savings accounts with banks, she says, they're also helping them spend less on payday lenders or money orders, money that could go into the emergency fund or retirement account. So that's step one, giving people the tools they need to save. But then you've got to get them to add to those accounts.
most of us can relate to the idea that saving money is not really very exciting, or worse, it might even be self-denial, some sense of self-deprivation.
Timothy Flocka heads a program called Doorways to Dreams, or D2D, in Boston.
So the question becomes, is there something we could do that would give us an immediate jolt of fun or tension or excitement?
On the fun front, D2D has created financial literacy video games, including one called Farm Blitz, where you manage a farm threatened by debt bunnies. Yeah, bunnies that multiply just like debt. D2D has come up with other strategies to get people to save, including prize-linked savings accounts, basically a lottery for savers,
where some or all of the financial return from savings, instead of being awarded in a guaranteed but frankly very low and not very exciting way, can be returned as prizes.
The program started in Michigan and has since expanded to other states, getting people to save by getting them to dream big about the future. Which brings us to another savings program in another city centered around those future dreams. Jose Cisneros is the treasurer of the city of San Francisco. It's got a program called Kindergarten to College
that automatically opens up college savings accounts for every child that enters the San Francisco public schools at kindergarten.
The city adds $50 to each of those accounts. And if parents contribute, private funders have partnered with the city to toss in a little more money. Cisneros says a few $100 isn't going to go far in paying for college, but it's meaningful in another way.
There's a recent study out of Washington University in St. Louis that shows that if a child grows up with a college savings account in the child's name, that child is 6 or 7 times more likely to go to college compared to a child without a similar account.
Even, Cisneros says, if that account doesn't have a ton of money in it.
The impact was all about having built aspirations in the child's mind.
Having savings isn't just about planning for the future. It can help shape that future. We want to know what future you're saving for and how you're doing it. We've got an interesting conversation going on our Facebook page where Stephen wrote in to say, quote, anyone who saves as much money as they can isn't living. You've got to balance security in the future with enjoying your current lifestyle. No doubt a statement that'll stir up a little controversy. We want to know what you think. We're devoting today's show to covering the basics of saving money in this part of our special series on personal finance. And one key to being a successful saver and pretty much successful at anything is asking the really basic questions. So we've got a good guide through our saving basics today, Liz Weston. She's a personal finance expert who can be found online at AskLizWeston.com. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Adrian.
So welcome to the show.
Thank you.
The U.S. savings rate is about 3.2% right now, which sounds low. I mean, is that as bad as it sounds?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's been worse, definitely right? Been worse. I think we got into negative territory for a while, so it is an improvement. But the reality is we need to be saving a lot more.
What does it tell us about the economy as a whole that we're saving at this 3% rate right now?
Well, obviously better than it was because, you know, people aren't having to raid their savings. They aren't having to put everything on a credit card.
Right.
But it does tell you that people are still struggling with incomes that are just not keeping up. You know, we are not back to where we were in the late 90s in terms of median income. So we've been losing ground all that time. And it's really tough for people when they don't have as much income and their costs are rising to prioritize and get everything done that they need to do.
So let's go to the phones right now. We have Judy on the line from Eagle Rock. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
So tell us, what's your question?
Well, I live paycheck to paycheck, pretty much. After my rent and groceries and everything, I'm left with maybe $10.
Ouch.
And I mean, I don't know if I should just get another job in order to save or, I mean, just put away $5. What can I do?
Yeah, what do you do when savings just isn't an option?
Well, and Eagle Rock is part of Los Angeles. It's a, you know, and Los Angeles is a very expensive place to live, mm-hmm. so it can be tough. You know, you can try looking at your expenses and see if you can cut, see if you can get a roommate, those kind of things. But honestly, the better thing to do is make more money, get more income. I don't know, what job do you do, Judy?
I'm a medical assistant.
Okay, so you're already in a field that's growing, so that's good. Is there a position you could get to if you got some more training or if you switched jobs that would pay you more?
Probably.
Okay.
Probably.
Do you have a family, Judy? Sort of what are your responsibilities?
I am a single mom. I have two boys. And, you know, it's really hard to take care of everyone and save money at the same time. But we started clipping coupons and, you know, doing little things like that. But it's still every dollar is a stretch.
Yeah. There's some great resources out there for you. The Dollar Stretcher is one of the oldest websites that, you know, looks at frugal living and thrifty living. And there's a lot you can do to trim expenses, especially when it comes to groceries. Even with two growing boys, you can really – that's probably where there's the most wiggle room in people's budgets. But I still come back to the fact you can only cut so far. And it really
right.
is easier to live your life, to have a more balanced budget, and to save if you're making more money. And I know it's tough being a single mom. You got the kids to look out for. How are you going to squeeze in, you know, studying, extra classes, things like that? It's definitely tough. But a little investment now could really pay off in the future, especially if you've got a job where you're not, you know, really earning enough to make a decent living.
So there's things like getting back to school, looking for another job, building an emergency fund. When you're dealing with $10 at the end of the month, what do you prioritize?
Yeah, that's really tough because what I always tell people, the priority has to be saving for retirement. And that just seems like, well, that's right. way down the list. Are you crazy? But, you know, you're going to get old faster than you think. And the fact is, it gets harder and harder to catch up the longer you put it off. So if you're in a situation where you're really left with 10 bucks after you've paid all the bills, you know, the quickest thing to do is look at the bill, see where you can cut. Look especially at the big expenses. Look at your rent. Look at what you're paying for a car. See if there's any way. Those are the hard ones to trim, but those are really big chunks of your budget. So if you can get those down, you can free up more money. But again, if there's a situation where you just can't cover all the bases, then you got to look at, okay, where can I get more income? If it's a job on the weekends, if it's a job after, you know, hours, if it's going back to school for a while, you know, maybe prioritize that for a while and get that paid for. But really, you got to get saving for retirement as soon as you can.
Why do you say that retirement accounts are more important than emergency funds? This seems like something that not everyone agrees on.
I know, and it's kind of counterintuitive until you understand the power of compounding and how powerfully it can work against you if you don't take advantage of it. Here's the thing. If you don't start saving for retirement by the time you're 35, say, it gets harder and harder and harder to catch up to the point where if you're trying to start in your mid-50s, you have to save almost half your income to
Wow.
have any shot at not having a big drop in your lifestyle. So people think, oh, I can put this off. I can catch up later. Well, the reality is you probably can't. And the money you put aside, the earlier you do it, the more time it has to grow. If you save adequately in your 20s and 30s, you got a tailwind behind you, and your life is going to be a heck of a lot easier than if you're trying to do other things first and then catch up.
Judy, I hope that helps. Good luck to you.
It does. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Liz, that brings me to another question about putting money to work. So let's say you do have a little bit of money to save. You want to build that emergency fund. Right now, putting money in a bank can feel kind of like a loser's deal, right? I mean, the consumer price index went up 0.5% last month. I can't get that in my bank account
yeah,
in a year.
I know.
What do you do? How do you think about sort of saving and, you know, and feeling good about it?
Well, think about what an emergency fund is for. That is the cash that you need to grab or may need to grab really quickly. You don't want to put it at risk at all. It needs to sit there in its rocking chair and be ready for you when you need it. So that means an FDIC insured bank account. Now, you can get a little bit more than the 0.25% you're getting at your brick and mortar bank by going online. You know, Capital One has an online bank, Ally, mm-hmm. Emigrant Direct, FNBO, all these places offer a little bit more. So that's a place to put it.
So this brings us to our next caller, Shannon in Memphis, Tennessee. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
So what's your question?
My husband and I have finally saved up a bit of an emergency fund It's enough to cover us for about 3 months if there was an emergency, you know, our most important expenses. And so the question is, what's the best place for this money? But then the other question is more of a general sort of philosophy. How accessible should this money be? Like, how liquid does it need to be?
Oh, okay. Yeah, those are great questions.
They are good questions. And what's the answer?
Well, very, very, very liquid. I mean, this is the money that you may need if you lose your job tomorrow. So it needs to be somewhere where you can get to it. But interestingly, it shouldn't be too easy to get to. I don't like to have emergency funds at the same bank where I have my checking account. You know,
Why not?
Because it's just a little too easy to transfer things over. You know, and now that we're all connected online, maybe that's just a barrier that exists in my head. But when I have to go to my online bank and transfer the money out, it's a little bit more of a big deal. And I know some people who keep their money, their emergency fund, in a credit union. They do nothing else at the credit union, but they've got it there. So they actually have to walk in to get the money. So if you have this situation where you keep building up an emergency fund and then you keep spending it and not necessarily for emergencies, you may want to put a little barrier there. But other than that, the money needs to be really, really accessible.
So should we be taking the money that we currently have and moving it? We do have a separate bank account with checkings and savings account, and then we do have an online account that is a cash account. Should we be moving it just into that cash account?
Well, the nice thing about online banks is that you can create sub-accounts and you can label them whatever you want.
So, yes, I've actually done this. I have a vacation account and a future car account, and you can actually say, all right, we're going to move this much money here and this much money here. And, oh, look, I can afford a vacation.
Yeah, and it's really nice. And the thing that I liked about it is before I had all my emergency fund and those, you know, saving it for property taxes and insurance payments and all that. It was all in one big lump. And I never was really sure, did I have enough to cover this? Did I have enough to cover that? So those online sub-accounts allow you to clearly label it. And now we have one thing that's just emergency fund. That's if, you know, the roof caves in, we got it covered. And then there's taxes and insurance and vacations and you know, Christmas or the holidays, whatever it is for you, all clearly labeled so you know how you're progressing towards those goals. And I just think that's kind of an easier way to run things than to worry about, oh, geez, what if Bernanke says the wrong thing and interest rates pop up again and I lose another 5% of my bond fund? I think it's just easier to put it in some boring, easily accessible place. Another idea that I wanted to throw out is if you're not saving enough for retirement, and you're worried about an emergency fund, because to me, retirement is more important than that emergency fund.
Okay.
But if you want to try to do both, a Roth IRA might be something to look into. And
now, this is a basic show, so I'm going to stop you here, Liz, and have you define.
Okay.
Since all this month we're focusing on the basics, Roth IRA.
Okay. A Roth IRA is a retirement savings vehicle. You don't get any tax deduction when you put the money in, but all the money comes out in retirement tax-free. So for a lot of people, the Roth IRA is the best thing since sliced bread. The other thing that's good about it is what I just explained, that when you put your contributions in, you can always take them back without any tax consequences. That's not true of the earnings that the money makes, but if you put in $2,000, you can always take that $2,000 out. So some people use it as sort of a hybrid between, you know, retirement and emergency fund. Now, if it's retirement, you want to invest it for retirement. That means stocks and bonds. That means taking some risk. But in the back of your mind, you can always think, well, in an emergency, I can, you know, pull out my contributions and not have to worry about taxes.
Great. Shannon, I hope that helped.
Yeah, that does help. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to the show.
Yeah, I enjoy it.
So, Liz, I'm going to have you stick around. We're going to talk more about other types of retirement accounts when we come back. This is Marketplace Money from APM. Personal finance expert Liz Weston is with us now answering some of our basic questions about savings and retirement accounts. We just talked about Roth IRAs, but I wonder if you can go through other types of retirement accounts for us. Just basics, what do you got to know?
Oh, there's so many of them. So it's kind of an alphabet soup. But really, for most people, the most important is the 401k that they've got at work. Mm-hmm. 401k is a workplace retirement plan that allows you to put aside money with a tax deduction for retirement. It grows tax deferred. You get to take that money and invest it in various options so that it has a chance to grow. And with most companies, you also get a match, which is free money. Free money is always good. If you don't have a 401k or a 403b, something like that at work.
And a 403b is?
Like a 401k, but it's usually offered by hospitals or nonprofits.
Great.
So just a different part of the tax code works pretty much the same. So if you don't have one of those at work, that doesn't mean you're off the hook. You still have to save for retirement. Want to look into traditional IRAs, which is a retirement account you can set up yourself. This year, you can put in $5,500 if you're under 50, or an extra $6,000, so $6,500 if you're 50 or over. And with a traditional IRA, you do get a tax break, mm-hmm. you know, with the money that you put in typically. And then we talked about Roths, which are another way to go. It's a way to have money in different tax buckets in retirement. Because when you put money into a 401k or a 403b or a traditional IRA, it's typically taxable when it comes out.
Okay.
You put money in a Roth, it's not taxable. So you can kind of manage your tax bill in retirement. That's why people are so excited about Roths and talk about it all the time.
Now, why would you choose a traditional instead of a Roth?
I think if you are like most people, you're going to be in a lower tax bracket in retirement. Mm-hmm. So the tax break is more valuable now than it will be then. The other thing is you're probably going to spend all or most of your money. So another big advantage of the Roth is that you don't have to take the money out during your lifetime. That's a real boon for people who have a lot of money, don't expect to use it all in retirement, and want to pass it on to their kids. So, you know, a Roth is great for that, but most people aren't going to be able to take advantage of that. So there's a lot of, you know, things to think about when you're
right.
doing this, and it's really tough. But what I usually say, if you're young and you're saving a lot for retirement, then take advantage of your 401k, but also consider the Roth. If you are struggling to catch up, if you're not in that high, you know, if you don't expect to be in that high of a tax bracket in retirement, maybe go with the traditional IRA instead.
And one other question we get a lot on Facebook and from our listeners is whether or not you should roll over your work retirement accounts when you take that next job.
Yes.
What do you think?
Well, don't cash it out.
Right.
That's the most important thing. Way too many people do that. Like 42% just cash it out.
When they take another job.
Yeah, and it's crazy. It's like, or when they lose their job, mm-hmm. maybe they think they need that money, you know, for living expenses, but you lose 25 to 50% of it to taxes and penalties, and you lose all that beautiful future tax deferred compounding. And I tell people, you know, if you take out $1,000 from a retirement plan, that's going to cost you at least $10,000
wow.
in future retirement funds. If you're younger, it costs even more. If you do that in your 20s, every $1,000 costs you $20,000. So don't do it. Now, a lot of the, you know, companies out there are trying to get you to roll your 401k into their IRAs. The reason they're so excited about that is because you're likely to pay more.
Okay.
Because retail funds and IRAs typically are more expensive. So if you're leaving a big company and they have a great retirement plan and they have lots of good choices, institutional funds that are really cheap, maybe you just want to leave it there.
And just have two retirement accounts from
yeah.
work.
There are worse things than having too much money in too many accounts. So the other thing you could do is transfer it, if your new employer agrees, transfer it directly into the new plan. Then you've got one less to worry about. And it's not a bad thing to roll it over into an IRA. Just be careful about what you're paying for those funds that you're buying with it.
Great. And we've got one more question for us. Now, Aaron in Portland, Oregon, are you here with us?
I am.
So tell us your situation.
Well, I was juggling for about 6 months with the decision of whether or not to pull some money out of my 401k account to fund a down payment for my first house or my first condominium.
And you just heard Liz give every reason not to do it, and you went ahead and did it, right?
I did. And let me give you just a little bit of a context in the background. We have a defined benefit 401k, so there's no match. The company automatically specifies a certain percentage of your salary and then a performance compensation bonus. So by taking out money, I was not hurting a match. So that was part of it. And the other part is here in Portland, it was the time to get into the market. Prices were at bottom and were rising. Interest rates were rising. And my job situation, I made the judgment call that it was going to be stable for long enough to get a positive return on the condo, which is about two and a half years.
And Aaron, how old are you?
38.
And how are you feeling about the decision now that you've got this condo?
Well, I close next week, so it's not in my hands yet. I feel positive about it. I would not have made this decision a year ago. But as a year went by, I have enough money in my emergency fund to cover paying back the entire 401k loan in case I was laid off tomorrow. So I wouldn't have to do that prepay penalty. And that made all the difference, was having that emergency fund large enough so that if trouble did come up, I might be broke and have to put expenses on credit cards. But at least I wouldn't lose 30% of my retirement for a pre-withdrawal.
Aaron said the magic word, loan. Loans are very different from withdrawing money from an IRA or another workplace plan. So,
explain that.
Okay. A loan from a 401k is something that you can pay back. You're essentially borrowing your own money and paying it back over time. I'm assuming you've got a 5-year repayment plan, Aaron,
correct.
Is that right? Okay. And what's the interest rate that you're paying on that?
Oh, I think it's 3%.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not going to beat you up over that. I mean, sometimes opportunities come up. I don't think people should be quick to tap into their retirement funds. I really think they should double and triple think before they ever withdraw money, which is what some people do. They think, oh, I can take $10,000 out of my IRA for a down payment. I'm going to do that. You don't have to pay penalties on that, but you do have to pay the taxes. And again, what we talked about, the loss of all that beautiful tax-deferred compounding. So
right.
You really don't want to be cracking into those nest eggs prematurely if you can avoid it. But here you have something that probably is going to grow in value, the purchase that he made. And he's not taking the money out permanently. He's just borrowing it and putting it back. And as he said, at the big downside of 401k loans, you lose your job, you have to pay that money back. He's got a source he can tap to do that. So actually, Aaron, you have my blessing. He didn't do a bad thing.
Congratulations, Aaron.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And thanks for taking my question.
You bet. Enjoy that condo.
Will do. Cheers.
And Liz, thanks so much. I feel like we've learned a ton about savings today.
I'm so pleased.
Liz Weston is a personal finance expert. Her latest book is The 10 Commandments of Money, Survive and Thrive in the New Economy. Thanks so much, Liz.
My pleasure, Adrian.
Right now on Facebook, we're taking your questions about investing for next week's show. Visit our page or pretty much ask us anything at marketplacemoney.org. For the next few shows, we're putting the practical in personal finance, taking a look at how we bank, how we spend, invest, advice on what we really need to know. And this week, our theme is savings. The feds actually keep track of this. They call it personal saving as a percentage of disposable personal income, which is pretty much a fancy way of saying the personal savings rate. It was 3.2% in May, and that was the highest rate reported all year for us here in the U.S., As we talked about earlier in the show, these fluctuations often reflect larger economic trends and maybe a little of the history of this place, of social norms. So we thought we'd take a trip to check out the saving behavior in other countries. First stop, Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Adrian.
So the Brits, spenders or savers?
Well, there are two stories here. I mean, there's what people did before the crisis and what they've done since. Before, they went absolutely crazy. I mean, they went on a spending binge. Household debt here soared. As a percentage of GDP, it hit 170%. And the savings rate, as a consequence, fell.
What were they spending on before the recession?
The biggest driver, really, was houses, actually. So you can't really blame the Brits. This wasn't really fecklessness. It's because house prices just spiraled out of control.
How did the financial crisis change things? What's the second part of the story there?
You'd think that people now would start battening down the hatches and start saving a lot more because they were sweating their jobs and they were worried about the future. Actually, they've been saving even less as a nation.
Why?
Since 2009. Now, they have to some extent been paying down their debt. And most crucially, the British government and the Bank of England have declared war on saving. I mean, they have punished the savers. They've driven down interest rates to derisory levels. So you get, after tax, only about 0.3% or 0.1% on a savings account.
And so what are savers doing, or folks who want to save?
Well, they're doing a variety of things. They're basically not saving. I mean, that's the main thing.
They've just given up.
I think they accept the basic point here that the British government and the Bank of England say, yes, we are punishing savers. But we've got to do that. I mean, this comes back to this notion which was pioneered by the British economist John Maynard Keynes in the 20s and 30s, the paradox of thrift. It may make perfect sense for individuals to watch their pennies and to save their money, but that's not much good for an economy as a whole, which needs consumer demand, especially an economy like the UK. Nevertheless, there is a lot of resentment in the UK now that these ultra-low interest rates represent a transfer of wealth from savers to borrowers, and many savers regard that as theft.
One thing that you have there that we don't as much in the US is a more robust sort of safety net and social services that are paid for by the government a little bit more. And I wonder how that affects the savings rate.
I think it does have an influence. I think it does actually hold down the savings rate. I mean, the Brits are not saving anything like enough for a decent retirement, and public spending is coming under huge pressure. The government is now having to borrow something like $200 billion a year to pay its way. And this is a much smaller economy than the US economy. The welfare benefits and the state pensions are likely to contract over time. There is a pensions time bomb here ticking away.
Stephen Beard is the European Bureau Chief for Marketplace. Thanks so much.
It's my pleasure, Adrian.
Next stop, the country with the world's highest savings rate, China. Why so high? Well, we called up Rob Schmitz. He's our bureau chief in China. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Adrian.
So how much do the Chinese actually save?
I've lived in China for years, and I've got a lot of Chinese friends, and I've always been sort of blown away by how adept they are at saving money. Most people I know here put away around half their monthly salary straight into their savings.
Wow.
Yesterday, I went outside here in Shanghai. I found a shady spot away from the hot sun, and I asked a bunch of people this question, you know, what do you save? And I think this answer from Fan Qinhao, a 31-year-old who runs an office equipment company, is pretty typical. So Mr. Fan is saying here that he saves half his monthly income in case of a medical emergency. And if we were playing Family Feud, this would be the number one answer on the survey board here in China.
But I thought in China there's healthcare for everybody.
Well, you know, China does have a quote-unquote universal healthcare system that covers everyone. And it's great if you catch a cold and you need someone to take your temperature. But it doesn't cover the very things you'd want health insurance to cover, which are the most specialized and expensive medical procedures. So let's say you're riding your bike to work and you're hit by a car and you require surgery. China's state health insurance program isn't going to cover much of that. If you make an average middle-class salary in China, you'll probably have to fork out half a year's salary for the surgery and rehab. And everyone I spoke to said the one thing China's government could do to encourage them to spend more would be to have a meaningful state health insurance program that really covers everything.
Now, what happens if you don't have this savings account? What do you do?
In China, if you don't have that, you're going to have to come up with the money, because most hospitals in China will demand money up front before they even touch you.
That's quite an incentive to save. What else could the government there do to help get people spending?
Everyone I talk to puts their savings into the bank, where interest is around 3% if they're lucky, so it's not so great. Up until a couple of years ago, folks invested their money in property, but it got out of hand and created a bubble, and now fewer people can afford to buy property. And the government has limited the number of properties you can own to a person. Investing in the Chinese stock market is also very risky, so most people stay away from that. And the government also makes it difficult to invest your money into foreign markets. So people are sort of stuck with the state banks, unfortunately.
And so it sounds like the government there in China is pretty much what's standing in the way of spending and maybe encouraging all this saving. Is that right?
Yeah, it's pretty contradictory. And you know, China's new leadership under President Xi Jinping understands, I think, that the old economic growth formula of building roads, high-speed rail, and luxury condos everywhere has created a lot of waste. And in order to build a healthier, more balanced economy, it needs to get people to spend. Household income in China is equal to half the country's GDP. As comparison, household income in the U.S. is at 80% of GDP. Mm. The Chinese government owns too much of China's economy, and in order to get the Chinese to spend, it's going to have to share more of that money with the people.
Rob Schmitz is the China correspondent for Marketplace. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Adrian.
Now to our last stop, Brazil. The country is in the midst of protests over healthcare, education, and rising transportation costs. Brazil has also seen a rise in its middle class and a rise in income. They're using their money to buy appliances, cars, computers, and smartphones. Julia Dias Carneiro is a reporter with the BBC in Brazil. We reached her by phone in Rio de Janeiro to ask whether these newly middle-class folks are saving any money now.
Well, there are lots of researches lately that show that Brazilians are not, at least it seems like it, in the habit of saving money. This seems to be visible in this new middle class. People are managing to get more money, so they're finally managing to buy things that they didn't have in the past and they didn't have in their homes. I heard of a lady the other day that bought a wash machine paying in 24 times, so 24 installments, and she said that she wouldn't consider saving up this money during 2 years instead of paying in installments because she was dying to have her wash machine and to be able to stop doing laundry in the tank as she had done for years and years. So it's this example of how people want to see their lives improve.
And why isn't there a culture of saving in Brazil? What is it about Brazil that maybe leads, or the history of Brazil that leads people not to be savers?
In the 70s and in the 80s, when it was the period of the military dictatorship here in Brazil, this drove to a huge hyperinflation. So in the early 80s, people really had to spend their money as fast as possible because things were devalued very quickly. I remember as a little girl, my mother, as soon as the salary came in, she'd go to the supermarket and come back with the car packed with things because that was a day to do all the buying because two days later, that money would already be worth a lot less. And only 10 years later, in the early 90s, there was a president here called Fernando Collor that one of his economic plans of his government was to freeze people's savings for a certain period of time. And it was a trauma for many people because from one day to the other, they woke up not having access to their savings. So it didn't really contribute for people to believe in that institution of putting that money there in the bank in a savings account and considering that it was safe.
Julia Dias Carneiro is a reporter with the BBC in Brazil. Julia, thanks so much.
Thank you, Adrian.
For more on savings rates around the world, check out our website, marketplacemoney.org. Basics of personal finance this month. How to save, how to invest, and we thought it might be time for you to invest in some good summer money-related reading. Here are a few suggestions.
Hey, I'm Kristen Wong, a writer for Get Rich Slowly. The book I'm recommending is Barbara Stanley's Secrets of Six-Figure Women. I sort of feel like it should come with a disclaimer, though, because one of her first chapters, Nine Traits of Under-Earners, can make you a little uncomfortable. Basically, in this chapter, she outlines what traits hold us back from becoming high earners. And unfortunately, I found myself able to relate to many of these traits. But progress isn't possible without change, and this book really took me out of my comfort zone. So the author interviewed 150 high-earning women and detailed what qualities these successful women all have in common. And while most of us probably don't possess all of these qualities, I think we can relate to some of them. And it is geared toward women, but I think men would find her research every bit as helpful.
I'm Chris Farrell of Marketplace Money. My most recent book is The New Frugality, How to Consume Less, Save More, and Live Better. For your summer reading, I recommend Behind the Beautiful Forevers by Catherine Boo. Beautiful Forevers reads like a novel, a compelling page-turner. It's the true, moving story about slum dwellers in Mumbai, India. The main characters are waste pickers. They scavenge for scrap metal, plastic, and other materials to sell to local recycling plants. Hard, dangerous work. These slum dwellers nevertheless struggle to create better lives for themselves and their children. We live far from the slum dwellers of Mumbai, physically and financially. Yet there's much to learn from them.
Hi, I'm Richard Eisenberg, editor of the Money and Work channels for NextAvenue.org, the new website for people over the age of 50 from PBS. As you can probably imagine, I read a lot of books about retirement and retirement planning, and that's sometimes a scary subject. But the retirement book I want to recommend is a happy one. In fact, it's called How to Retire Happy, and it's by Stan Hinden, a financial reporter who used to write the Washington Post syndicated column Retirement Journal. The great thing about How to Retire Happy is that Stan Hinden's not just a financial writer, he's retired. So he's speaking from experience. Some of my favorite parts of the book are when Stan talks about the mistakes he made. For instance, Stan and his wife expected to follow the rule that financial advisors use and live on 80% of their pre-retirement income when they retired. Turns out, they spent more than 80% because they love to travel. So Stan and Sarah found a few ways to cut back on their expenses, and guess what? They retired happy.
And for more book picks, head on over to our website, marketplacemoney.org. And now it's time for another money mystery.
Mortgage-backed securities.
Ooh, look what Scooby found!
To keep the level of yield in your portfolio constant.
What do you think it means?
Subsidized, unsubsidized.
I don't know, but something tells me we'll soon find out.
Today, Megan Cohen of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York shares the story of the icon of saving money, the piggy bank.
Piggy bank actually originates from a term that they used in the Middle Ages called pig jars. Pig jars were made of pig, which is a form of clay. Essentially, these pig jars were used to store all sorts of different things, household items, including money. And over time, when it was used to store money, people referred to it as piggy banks. Originally, the pig jars were an orange clay, and it really had no connection to pigs at all. And at some point, people got the humor behind pig meaning both clay as well as the animal, and people started making the jars in the shape of pigs. I can make some guesses as to why pigs are now considered the sign of money, and I really do think it comes down to the piggy jars that every child gets throughout their childhood. Most kids have a piggy bank. So when you think of saving money, you think of putting the coins in the piggy bank. My daughter does exactly that with her coins. So as people grow up, they think of savings, they think of piggy banks, and it just becomes a very common touchstone for people to think of that as a money piggy bank connection.
Megan Cohen is the Senior Information Management Specialist at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. We've been gathering pictures of piggies over on our Twitter account, at Radio Piggy Bank, including an airplane bank from Sarah on the Go. We're coming to the end of the show on savings, and you've heard Americans aren't the best savers. So remember some of the advice from today. First, from Professor Suzanne Hsu at UCLA, create a savings account where it deducts money from your paycheck or checking account.
Set it up so that it automatically, every month, puts some money aside, even if it's not tons of money, even if you're not sure how it should be invested or what to do with it, just get started. Do something to get started.
That's what one of our listeners wrote in on Facebook. Wendy says she uses automatic deposits to her savings account. She treats it just like a monthly bill. And here's another key. Find a way to make your savings have a short-term benefit, Professor Hsu says.
For every $100 you put away into a long-term savings account, maybe put $10 away into a more short-run savings account, and at the end of 6 months, take yourself out to a nice dinner.
Now, it doesn't have to be that exact ratio. Just give yourself a little fun today as you save for the future. Also, always remember to treat your nest egg with respect, especially retirement accounts. Liz Weston is a personal finance expert.
I don't think people should be quick to tap into their retirement funds. I really think they should double and triple think before they ever withdraw money. You really don't want to be cracking into those nest eggs prematurely if you can avoid it.
She answered listener savings questions today, including one from a caller who lives paycheck to paycheck but wants to save. Liz's advice?
You know, you can try looking at your expenses and see if you can cut, see if you can get a roommate, those kind of things. But honestly, the better thing to do is make more money, get more income.
You can get more from our show on savings. Check out marketplacemoney.org. And that'll do it for Marketplace Money. Next week, the ABCs of investing.
You don't invest actively, either doing it yourself or picking active mutual fund managers, unless you have some reason to think that you can do it better than the average person.
Send us your questions, marketplacemoney.org, or you can get in touch on our Facebook page or on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch and Nancy Fargali, with Lindsay Foster Thomas and Daryl Perinata, and help this week from Raghu Manavalan. Chris Clark is our engineer. Deborah Clark is the Marketplace Vice President and Executive Producer of the program. I'm Adrienne Hill. Have a great weekend. This is APM.